Ready for your two questions? Who's not in a group yet? Okay, I'm going to stop asking that question. I'm going to assume everybody is in a group, right? Who's not picked a company yet? Be honest. Who's not picked a company? Really, every person. So if I called on one of you and said, who are you valuing, you'd be able to name a company? Okay, good. I'm not going to pick on you. I'm going to assume you do. Yeah. So we're off to the races. By now, you already have, your project is already in motion, if you're keeping up, which is you have to have a discount rate. Today, we're going to talk about the rest of the cost of capital calculation. But before we go there, one of the things we're going to talk about today is we're going to move from discount rates to earnings and cash flows. Okay? So one of the rules in valuation is you want to value a company as of right now. You know why? You remember the first session when I talked about valuation? I said, why do we do valuation? It's not because we're intellectually curious. It's because we want to act on the valuation. And if you want to act on a valuation, what's the point of valuing a company as of January 1st, 2019? What am I going to do with it? You want to value a company as of right now, which could be May 11th of 2020 if you're turning in. But there's a challenge you will face. Some of your numbers you can get as of right now, right? Interest rates right now, equity risk premiums right now. But a big chunk of your numbers come from accounting statements. And you want to get the most updated accounting numbers you can. But the problem is accountants don't update every minute of every day. So here's my first question. You're trying to value a company. You want to use updated financials for your company or updated earnings for your company. I'm going to give you four choices, two of which are terrible, but I'm going to put them on the table anyway, and two of which are potential candidates. First, how many of you are going to use the earnings from the most recent annual report? Who are you doing? When was the last annual report? Probably 2018. It's a calendar year end, which means you're valuing a company in 2020 with 2018 financials. It might be complete, but it's old. Now, many of you are going to get lucky. You know why? Because sometime in March or April, if you have a calendar year end, your annual reports are going to get updated. But God help you if you're valuing Apple, because Apple's year end is September. You say, look, can I turn the project in October? Definitely not. Okay? Which means you have to come up with your own way of updating numbers. So I'll give you the second choice. Can I just take the last quarterly numbers and multiply by four? It's a quarter. Quarter times four is a year, right? What's wrong with that? They're kind of strange things. Right now, for instance, Apple's going to report lower revenue. They've already told you. Why? Because the coronavirus, in fact, at least that's the excuse they're using. If I multiply by four, I'll take the virus times four. No, good. You know, that'll be terrible. So don't do that. That's not on the table. I've kind of guided you to the third choice. Most companies across the world now report quarterly statements. Quarterly. It's not full. It's not as complete as the annual report, but it's pretty complete. You can take the last four quarters and add them up, and you've got what's called a trailing 12-month number. That number can never be more than 2 or 3 months old because it is pretty close. So that's one candidate, using a trailing 12-month number. I'll give you a very simple technique for doing, because what's your natural reaction? Trailing 12-month, I've got to go collect four quarterly reports together. You don't need it. If you have one annual report and one quarterly report, you can do a trailing 12-month number because the information reported in a quarterly report will allow you to get a trailing 12-month number. That's one choice. The other is, if you think about it, for many of your companies, if you have a calendar year end, you have three complete quarters for 2019, right? And some of your companies have telegraphed what the last quarter of 2019 is going to look like Apple. Maybe you can estimate the fourth quarter. It's going to be an estimate. Add that on. Those are the real two choices. You can either use trailing 12-month numbers or get that fourth quarter, if that's the only thing that's missing, and create a 2019 number that is pretty close to the truth. I prefer to stay with trailing 12-month because I don't like to make estimates just to get started. But you want the most updated numbers you can. So we'll come back and talk about it, because your question might be, what if I'm in a market where companies don't update every quarter? What if I'm stuck with 2018 annual reports? We'll talk about what to do then. But at least for 95% of the companies in the world, there is this trailing 12-month option. Second question. One of the items you subtract out to get to cash flows is capital expenditures. It's a standard item. And if you look at the accounting definition of CapEx, it's pretty narrow. But my question is, if you think of CapEx as what you're putting into a company to get growth in the future, which of the following would you count as CapEx? Would building a plant count as CapEx? Obviously, right? How about R&D expenses? Don't think like an accountant. Remember I said you got to get rid of that accounting mindset very quickly. Is that Siri or is that... it's Siri. Siri is stupid. I hate to say this, but Siri needs a lot of reprogramming. Yeah? R&D expenses. It should be obviously capital expenditures, right? What about advertising for a consumer product company? Some advertising is for people to get stuff now, but if you're a consumer product company, you're building a brand name, advertising might be what you spend to get the brand name. How about customer acquisition costs for Netflix or Uber? Do you see where I'm going? The accounting definition of CapEx includes just item A. If you build a plant, they would show it as CapEx. None of these other items would show up as CapEx in an accounting financial statement. One of the things we're going to talk about today is redoing the accounting statements. Because if I'm valuing Facebook or Apple, there is no plant and equipment that I have to think about. I have to think about R&D. I have to think about other costs. If I'm valuing Netflix, maybe customer acquisition costs are my CapEx. And that's going to create a whole lot of pain for us because we essentially have to redo the financials. And finally, we might or might not get a tax rate for that. But when you think about tax rates, there are two different tax rates I want you to think about. One is called an effective tax rate. It's actually an accounting measure. Does anybody know the definition? How do we measure effective tax rates? When a company reports an effective tax rate, how is it calculated? You've got to be careful. It's the taxes from the income statement, which is an accrual tax. It's actually not cash taxes. It's accrual taxes divided by accrual taxable income. The reason I emphasize the word accrual is what you show as an effective tax rate might not be the cash tax you pay. There's a deferred tax that shows up. So an effective tax rate is the accrual taxes paid divided by accrual income. How many of you are doing your own taxes this year? You're doing? What do you use? TurboTax? No. I use TurboTax. I've ended up becoming the tax preparer for the whole family. My daughter shows up yesterday. What am I, W-2? Do my taxes. So how much are you paying me? Nothing, but no, that's okay. Daughters don't pay you. Yeah? But when you do TurboTax, at the end of the process, you know, they go make you jump through, especially if you go through the easy step thing, they make you go through all these things. I don't know, did you pass away in the last year? If I passed away, how would I be doing my taxes right now, right? But questions like that, you go through all the questions. At the end of the process, you say, congratulations, you're done with your taxes, and this year, I think just to depress you, you pay 25% of your adjusted gross income in taxes. They take your taxes paid, divided by your adjusted. It's an effective tax rate. See, effective tax rate is the percentage of your total taxable income that you're paying in taxes. There's a different tax rate called a marginal tax rate. What's a marginal tax rate? What do you pay on your additional dollar? I'm going to give you a really depressing afterthought for those of you who plan to live and work in New York. You know what a marginal tax rate is? First, you have to pay federal taxes. So let's pick one of you. Let's make you a really successful investment banker. You're making $250,000. You're feeling good, right? Don't feel too good because now the tax guy is coming. If you make $250,000, you know what your marginal federal tax rate is. Anybody know? It's 37%. Okay, so that's the first step. We're not done yet. That's a federal guy comes and collects 37%. You know what the New York State tax is going to be on your marginal dollar? It's about 9%. I'm not quite done. So 37% plus 9%. And then you're in New York City. You don't want to live in Hoboken because that sounds so out there, you're an investment bank, you live in the city. You know what the city tax is? It's another 3.5%. It's only a matter of time before Chelsea says, you know what, guys, they've all beaten you up. Let me beat you up too, to another 2%. You're going to be paying at the margin about 48% of your last dollar of income as taxes. Luckily, it won't be 48% of the entire income. That's the effective tax rate. It might be only 32%, but in your last dollar, you're paying 48, 49, 50% of your income in taxes. That's your marginal tax rate. Say, who cares? We're going to see both numbers play out when we talk about cash flows and discount rates. And we'll talk about why. But when we talk about effective and marginal tax rate, so if you think about this at a corporate level in the U.S., that marginal tax rate for companies until 2017 in the U.S. used to start at 35%. That was the federal tax rate plus state and local. By the time you were done, the typical U.S. company on the marginal dollar was paying 40% of its income in taxes. After the 2017 tax law changed, the federal corporate tax rate has dropped to 21%. So today it's closer to 25%. So marginal tax rates now in the U.S. are about 25%. So we'll talk about effective tax rates and marginal tax rates and why the two might diverge and which one to use where in valuation, because each has its place. So let's go back to where we were in a... So last session, we were kind of wrapping up the cost of equity. Let me bring everything together because this page allows me to kind of talk about everything we did last session. So I'm going to take piece by piece each item in the cost of equity, and you guys are going to help me decide how to come up with that number. First, I need a risk-free rate, right? And what determines that number? What currency I've decided, not country, what currency I've chosen to do the valuation, and I want a risk-free rate in that currency. For some currencies is going to be easy, like the US dollar, maybe the euro, maybe the Swiss franc. Some currency is going to be messier, the Indonesian rupiah, the Brazilian real, the Indian rupee. So risk-free rate is driven by a currency choice. Then we get to the beta. The way we were taught to estimate betas is run a regression, but after last session, hopefully that's not where you end up. Your beta comes from what business or businesses you're in and how much value you get from each business. So remember the Vale example. So betas reflect the business choices. And complete the process, what drives my equity risk premium? Where my revenues come from, not where I'm incorporated. If I'm an oil company, it might be where my production comes from. It comes from my operations. Risk-free rate reflects a currency choice. Beta reflects the businesses you're in. The equity risk premium reflects the countries you operate in. You bring them all together, you got the cost of equity. That was a lot of work to get the cost of equity. But equity is only one of two ways you can raise money, right? What's the other? I can raise debt. So let's mop up. Let's talk about the cost of debt and talk about how to incorporate that and come up with the cost of capital. So the cost of equity is what my equity cost me. Let's talk about the cost of debt. The cost of debt is the rate at which I can borrow money long-term today. I kind of mentioned this in the last class, but might as well restate it. Long-term today. Let me explain why I threw the two words at that. You might have a lot of short-term debt and tell me your cost of debt is really low, but I'm not going to buy. I'm going to say, look, I don't care if your debt is 6 months, 1 year, 2 years. I'm going to act like it's long-term debt because you've got to roll over your debt. And it's got to be the rate at which you can borrow money today, which means you can't show me your bank loan from 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, because frankly, I don't care. So to get the cost of debt today, I'm going to start with the risk-free rate. Which risk-free rate? Remember, you made the currency choice already. So you're doing everything in U.S. dollars, it'll be a dollar risk-free rate. If you're doing everything in riyals, it'll be a riyal risk-free rate. And on top of that, I'm going to add a default spread. Think, what the heck is that? Think of it as a rate at which you borrow money today. When you go to a bank to borrow money today, the bank looks at your default risk. What are they going to base that on? Your history, your size, your financials. And based on that, they say, look, we're going to charge you 3% more than the risk-free rate. You add that to your risk-free rate, you're almost done. That becomes your pre-tax cost of borrowing. So the challenge with the cost of debt is estimating that default spread. So let's start easy. There are some companies where you can outsource this. You know when you outsource it? Let somebody else tell you what the default risk in the company is. What am I talking about? What do some companies have that helps you assess default risk? They have a bond rating, a credit rating. There are thousands of companies around the globe, but 15% of all global companies have a bond rating, Moody's, S&P. And you say, I don't trust ratings agencies. I don't either, but think of how much work they save you. So when Moody says you're a BAA-rated company, if you believe them, you have an assessment of default risk and you have something even better. Because if you tell me what the rating for a company is, I can tell you what the typical default spread is for that rating given how bonds are trading right now. So this is another table on my website where I update these numbers as well. So you tell me your rating, I'll come up with the default spread. Now you might say, if they have bonds, why can't I just look at the interest rate on the bond? Choice, but here's the reason why I would not look at a bond interest rate even if it's available. Can a risky company issue a safe bond? You don't think so? Let's say you're a risky company, but a portion of your company is really safe. Predicted cash flows. You have a contract that's guaranteed cash flows. Could you issue a bond with that cash flow as collateral? Yeah, you can actually issue a secured bond against your safest assets. And if I look at that bond, the interest rate is going to be low. And if I extrapolate from there and say your cost of debt is only 4%, I'm going to underestimate your cost of debt. This is why even if there's a bond outstanding, I always go back to the rating to come up with the default spread. Because the rating is going to give me a rating for the whole company, not just this debt. So that's an easy scenario. If your company has a bond rating, you can use that rating to come up with a default spread. That's going to work for about 15% of all companies. But there are going to be 85% of companies where we'll run into trouble. There'll be no rating, no traded bonds. How do they borrow money? They go to the bank, they borrow money, and all the loans are owed. So here's what I'm going to give you as an alternative for those companies. I'm going to let you play ratings agency, and it's not that complicated. After all, ratings agencies don't come up with ratings out of thin air. They compute a bunch of ratios for companies. In fact, if you go to the S&P website, they list out the 9 ratios they claim to compute for companies to come up with a rating for a company. Things like interest coverage ratio, EBITDA to fixed charges, and you can see the 9 ratios. So about 25 years ago, I decided I want to play ratings agency. So I said, I'm going to rate companies. And they've given away the game. They've given me the 9 ratings. I'm going to reverse engineer what they do by looking at the companies they rate. You know what I mean by reverse engineer? They gave me the 9 ratios. I had the ratings for every company. So let's say I have 2,000 companies that are rated. I started looking for patterns. Can I get a sense of what exactly the... And it was actually very simple. It turned out that one ratio for non-financial service companies was doing the bulk of the lifting, and the rest were along for the ride. The one ratio that best explained differences in ratings across companies, the ratio called the interest coverage ratio. The interest coverage ratio is just earnings before interest and taxes divided by interest expense. So as an example, if you take Embraer, Embraer's operating income was about $462 million. Their interest expense was about $130 million. EBIT times interest expense gives me 3.56. Now I want you to think like a lender. When you're a lender, do you want that number to be a high number or a low number? You want it to be a high number because you want more buffer. Right? Because the higher that number, the more buffer you have that the earnings will cover your interest expense. The higher the number, the safer the company. If I can somehow take this number and convert it to a rating, it'll make your life easier, right? Because then you can look up a default spread. So here's what I did. I took the 2,000 rated companies and I started to create a lookup table based upon how ratings agents, and I said, if the interest coverage ratio is greater than this number, it looks like companies get AAAs, AAs. And the lookup table looks a little bit like this when I was done in 2004. So basically, I created 2 lookup tables because it looks like ratings agencies have 2 sets of rules, one for big companies and one for small companies. For big companies, you get a rating at a much lower interest coverage ratio, better rating, because if you're big, you're too big to fail. And if you're a small company, big and small here are relative. It's 5 billion was my cutoff for small. So it's a pretty big small company. So if you're less than 5 billion, more than 5 billion, and here's how it works. You tell me what your interest coverage ratio is. I'll go to this lookup table, look to see what rating would go with that interest coverage ratio, given whether you're a small or a big company, and say that is going to be a rating. And once I give you a rating, a default spread comes out of that rating. So let's take Embraer. Embraer's interest coverage ratio was 3.56. Remember, if you look at 3.56 on the interest coverage ratio table, they were a large market cap company. The rating I would give them would be 3 through, so it's right there, is A minus. And the default spread that went with that rating in 2004 was about 1%. I'm almost home. To get the cost of debt for Embraer, I'm going to give them a 1% default spread and that rating that came out of their interest coverage ratio. So if you don't have a rating for a company, you can use the interest coverage ratio, which you should have for every company. Use the interest coverage ratio to get a rating, and that rating can give you a default spread. So that 1% is Embraer's default spread. But Embraer is a Brazilian company. And you think, so what? This is where life gets unfair if you're from an emerging market. If you're a company from an emerging market, you carry two burdens on your shoulder. One is your burden as a company. The other is the burden of your country. It's really not fair. But talk to a Greek company about what's fair. If you're a Greek company, you go into a bank to borrow money. Say, I'm a Greek company. The banker says 35%. I haven't shown you my financials, 42%. The Greek in front of your company name already has pushed you up. And this actually used to be built into the ratings agencies as a ceiling. In fact, do you know until about 2003, ratings agencies had what was called a country ceiling on your rating. So if you are a company in a country which was double B rated, the best you could aspire to be, no matter how safe you were as a company, was a double B rating, which is really not fair if you're a company that gets a lot of revenues outside and you're much safer than the country. That ceiling is now gone, but the pain still remains that if you're an emerging market company, you carry two burdens. And here's how I'm going to reflect it. To get a cost of debt for Embraer, I started with the risk-free rate in dollars because I was doing my valuation in dollars, so that currency choice was made. I added the 1%. That's the spread I got based on its synthetic rating. And the default spread for Brazil was huge at the time. It was about 6%. But I chose to attach only two-thirds of that spread. Why? Because Embraer got so much of its revenues outside Brazil in dollars that my argument was Brazil might have a big default spread, but Embraer does not have to carry the entire burden. So when you're estimating the cost of debt for an emerging market company, start with a synthetic rating, get a default spread. And if your country has a default spread, you don't want to do the two-thirds, just add the entire country default spread. You will get a cost of debt for your company. So cost of debt is risk-free rate plus default spread. And if you have an emerging market, we have two default spreads, one for the company and one for the country. And that is your pre-tax cost of borrowing. But one of the nice things about borrowing is there's a tax advantage you get when you borrow money. And what's the tax advantage again? When you raise equity, what do I have to pay dividends and stock buybacks from? After-tax income. Dividends are not tax deductible. They come out of after-tax income. But when I borrow money and I have interest expenses, they're tax deductible. My after-tax cost of debt is what drives my cost of capital. The question you then face is, I've got a pre-tax cost of debt for Embraer of 9.29%. What tax rate? Remember we talked about effective versus marginal tax rates? Which of those two tax rates should I use to get my cost of debt? Let's step back. When I compute the effective tax rates for every publicly traded company and I report them by sector, by region around the world. Okay, so you know what the average effective tax rate for a U.S. company was last year? It was about 19%. The marginal tax rate was 25%. It used to be even worse. In 2017, the marginal tax rate was 40%. The effective was only about 22%. So here's my first question. Why is the effective tax rate lower than the marginal tax rates for most companies, and definitely on average across all companies? Why are effective tax rates lower than marginal? No, because effective tax rates, how do we compute effective tax rates? It's taxes divided by taxable income. Taxable income is already after interest expenses, so it can't be that you borrow money. Could it be because you rise in the tax brackets because when you're an individual, you make very little money, or you pay very... No, it's not tax brackets either, because once you get to about $5 million in income as a company, you're already at the highest tax bracket. If any of you worked at companies, they do have an entire tax department. What do those guys do? What's their job? It's to figure out ways where you push taxes into future years. Defer taxes. It's completely legal, right? And they might do it because you take advantage of portion of the tax law. So there's tax deferral going on, which allows you to have an effective tax rate lower than the marginal tax rate. Until 2017, there was another reason why the effective tax rate was lower than the marginal tax rate. The U.S. tax code was the most perverse tax code in the universe. Because until 2017, here's how the U.S. tax code worked. If you're a U.S. company, a multinational, and you made income in the U.S., you were taxed at 40%, which is the... But if you made income in Hong Kong, it was taxed at 15%. And the U.S. then said, you pay the 15%. I don't write the tax law, so when I say the next thing, you're going to say, that is stupid. When you bring that money back to the U.S., we're going to charge you the extra 25%. You see where I'm getting the 25%? Who writes these stupid tax laws? So basically, you're telling multinationals, if you make money overseas, when you bring the money back, we're going to charge you the differential tax rate. What do you think companies did? They didn't bring the money back. Hence was born the concept of trap cash. So you heard the word trap cash. Who's trapping it? Where is it trapped? Trap cash was multinationals with income overseas. That money was trapped because if it came back to the U.S. to pay dividends or buybacks, you'd have to pay the extra tax rate. It was trapped because you could not use it in the U.S. for any purpose. You could use it outside the U.S. for whatever you wanted. It's extremely perverse because you're encouraging companies to do what? Go do acquisitions in other countries, do projects in other countries. Just don't do it in the U.S. These are the same politicians who then say, you know what, money's not coming back. They're not building factories in the U.S. Hey, guess what? And at the peak of this phenomenon, at the end of 2017, there were $3 trillion of cash trapped in other countries. You're saying it's not just the U.S., everybody does it. The U.S. was only one of six countries that has this stupid law. You don't want to know the other five because you want to hang out with these other five. I don't want to name them. The rest of the world has what's called a regional tax system, which means if you're a UK company in the UK, you have to pay the UK tax rate. But if you made income in Germany, you pay the German tax rate. Hong Kong, but you are done. You didn't have to pay the differential tax rate because it doesn't make any sense. So when you think about effective tax rates under 2017, Apple's effective tax rate was only 15%. It wasn't because they were playing huge tax deferral games even, because they had so much income outside the U.S. that they were paying much lower tax, and their effective tax rate was lower. So I've set up the game. If I want to compute an after-tax cost of debt for Apple, and it's 2017, I have two different tax rates, right? 17% is the effective, 40% is the marginal. Which one of those tax rates should I use to compute my after-tax cost of debt? I hear a marginal. Everybody agree with that? Why?
Because you can reduce the tax savings from these 40%.
But I'm paying only 15% of all of my income. Why can't I use the 15%?
Because that's not where you use your tax credit.
Do companies choose where to borrow? Can Apple borrow? Apple can borrow anywhere in the world, right? So guess where Apple borrowed its first $50 billion? It wasn't in Ireland. It wasn't in Hong Kong, it was in the U.S. because that's where they were paying the 40% tax rate. So even though your effective tax rate is 15%, your tax benefits from debt actually happen at the highest marginal tax rate, which is 40%. That's what made the tax code so perverse, is the tax code wasn't collecting any more in taxes than the German tax code or the U.K. tax code, but companies were borrowing a lot more because of the 40% marginal tax rate. You use the marginal tax rate when you compute the cost of debt because that is essentially what you will get as your tax benefit. Now, one caveat about the synthetic rating process that I just described, it was designed with U.S. company data because that's where you get the most rated companies. But the challenge I face is often I have to estimate synthetic ratings for European companies, Asian companies, Latin American companies, and there aren't enough rated companies to create this lookup table. And I often take the lookup table I've developed for the U.S. and used to come up with ratings for Embraer or Tata Consulting Services. Say, can I get away with it? For the most part, yes, and that's how I console myself. And here's the challenge. When you get to a market where interest rates are really high, the table tends to break down. Why? Because when interest rates are 15, 20%, you're not going to get interest coverage ratios of 6 or 7 because interest expenses start climbing. There you might have to redo the table. Things get messier. But for the most part, you still have this challenge of what's the default risk and coming up with the default spread that goes with it. So one thing about the default spread is it does change over time. In fact, remember that graph I showed you for the implied equity risk premium between September of 2008 and December of 2008 during the crisis, how much the risk premium changed? Guess what? The default spread also changed pretty dramatically over that period. So it's not just the equity risk premium that's dynamic. The default spreads are dynamic, which means the default spreads I have on my website on January 1st, 2020, you can still use them unless something catastrophic happens in markets, in which case I will have to redo the spreads, you will have to redo the spreads, because default spreads will change if there's a crisis in markets. So this actually shows you how default spreads have varied between 2015 and 2020. So if you look at 2020, it was a very good year for spreads. Why? Because spreads all decreased, which was why if you're a bond investor in 2019, not only did you make a lot of money from interest rates coming down, but spreads came down as well. So in a corporate bond, remember, lower interest rates, higher prices. So default spreads can change. And that lower default spread in 2019 is going to play into a much lower cost of debt and cost of capital across the board for all companies. One final point about debt before we let it go. Okay. So let's assume that you're looking at Embraer in 2004. If you remember, the pre-tax cost of debt I estimated for Embraer was 9.29%. But Embraer used to be a government company. It still has strong contacts with the Brazilian government. And the Brazilian government wants Embraer to grow because it's its pride and joy. It's a manufacturing company that makes aircraft, and Brazil is really proud of Embraer. So the Brazilian government decides to make a subsidized loan to Embraer. And this is not uncommon. In many markets around the world, governments, to encourage certain businesses, green energy, will give loans at a much lower, subsidized in what sense, at an interest rate much lower than what they would have to pay if they were borrowing outside. So remember, Embraer's market cost of debt is 9.29%. Let's say the Brazilian government lends them money at 6%. And you're sitting down to value Embraer. I have a very simple question. To get the cost of capital, I need a cost of debt. I was using 9.29% before because that was my cost of debt based on that default risk. Now the Brazilian government is giving this subsidized loan of 6%. Should I replace the 9.25% with the 6%? Why not? Yeah, but aren't they getting the loan at a lower rate, though? Isn't the capital cheaper? Let's step back. Is their value going to increase as a company because they get the subsidizing? Yes, right? So I have to show it somewhere. So if I don't show it in the cost of capital, and I actually agree with you, I should not, and I have a different reason, where would I show it? You can't, right? Are cash flows pre-debt cash flows? In fact, any kind of subsidy is kind of a mess because it takes the numbers you've estimated. So what do I do? I'll tell you why I would not short on the cost of capital. It is a true lower cost, 6%. But if I build it in the cost of capital and I leave it there, then I'm making a very dangerous assumption, which is not only will the government give me a 6% loan now, but they will keep redoing this loan over and over again. And we know subsidies run out. Right? There's a point at which the government takes the subsidy away. So rather than replace the 9.29% with 6%, here's what I'd suggest you do. Do the cost of capital and valuation with a 9.29% cost of debt, finish the valuation, and then value the subsidy separately. Do you see how you'd value the subsidy separately? What are you getting as your subsidy? The difference between 9.29 and 6% is, take that as your savings. You could say, look, I'll get this subsidy for the next 10 years. Take that subsidy for the next 10 years, discount it if you want to get fancy, and you will get a subsidy value. Add that onto your value as a company. And here's why I think that makes sense. Governments never do things expecting nothing in return. If you take a subsidy from the government, there's another shoe always waiting to drop. And the question I would ask you is, what does this subsidy cost you? And if you say nothing, I'm going to ask you to look again. I remember valuing an Indian company. It was a sugar company. And in India, sugar is subsidized by the Indian government. So basically, they get these subsidies, and the subsidies are good. But in return for getting the subsidies, you know what the sugar companies are required to do? They're required to sell sugar at a government-set price. So I said, okay, we'll cost out this, we'll value the subsidy for you. And after I valued the subsidy, I said, let's do something, a next step. And you know what the next step was? What if you turn the subsidy away and were able to sell sugar at market prices? How much higher would your revenues be? I valued how much they were giving up to get the subsidy. They were giving up 3 times more in value. Because what they were losing by charging these government set prices was much greater than what they were gaining from the subsidy. And that's why I'd prefer to keep subsidies separate from valuation. Because then you can ask the question, should I turn the subsidy down? Maybe you'd be better off as a green energy company not taking the subsidy and having to do all that additional stuff to now earn the subsidy. There's always a trade-off, and you have to decide whether the trade-off makes sense for your company or not. In fact, if any of you are working with green energy companies, don't be surprised to see this phenomenon show up, because many green energy companies around the world get subsidies from the government. Tesla, until very recently, every time you bought a Tesla car, the federal government gave you, what, a $500, $1,000 thing, because it's run out. I think it ran out last year from whatever number they got. But there is a subsidy they got, and that helped them. But the question is it a pure value increase, or is there something else that they're going to have to give up because of it? And that's a trade-off you're looking at. Any questions on cost of debt? So let's review. To get a cost of debt, you start with a risk-free rate. Same risk-free rate from which you start your cost of equity. But rather than go beta equity risk premium, you go with the default spread. You can either estimate the default spread directly if you have a rating, or indirectly by estimating a rating for your company and then doing a default spread based on that. You now have a cost of equity and a cost of debt, and the cost of debt you have to adjust for this tax benefit you get. Now, the last step is you need weights for debt and equity. Now, you open up any corporate finance valuation textbook. There's no contest. It's always market value weights. Market value of equity, which is market cap, and market value of debt, which is a little trickier because debt might not be traded, so many people use book value of debt, but the weights are supposed to be market value weights. Any of you working on your CFAs? Okay. Which CFA 1, 2, which one? CFA 1. It's a long and torturous process. They make you read like 36,000 pages, and then they ask you what was on page 8,255. You don't know. You fail the test because you have to fail about 70% of people. But it's a good test to get through because the CFA is actually much more finance-oriented than an MBA often is. I don't have a CFA, but I've given the keynote to the CFA thing for the last 25 years, and I open about it. I don't want to think about getting a CFA. But I beg them, will you let me write the exam 1 year? Because rather than make this, do you remember what's on page 8,655? My question will be, there'll be one question. You answer this question, you get all 3 levels of the CFA. And if you don't, you don't. You ready? So you're going to get an unofficial CFA if you can answer this question right. You can put CFA Demodrin if you want in brackets next to it. Okay. So here's the question. We're told to use market value weights for debt and equity. And I'm going to list a potential reasons. You tell me which one is the reason for why we use market value weights. Is it because the market is usually right? Why don't you want to pick that reason? Let's say you pick that reason. You say, that's why I'm using market value. You see the hole you've dug for yourself? What are you then going to do? You're going to put market value weights. You're going to come up with the cost of capital. You're going to use the cost of capital to value your company, and that value is going to be different from the market price, and you're going to ask me to buy or sell, and I'm going to turn around and say, but you told me the market's usually right. How come in this particular company you tell me it's wrong? So you don't want to go down that road, because when you do intrinsic valuation, you're starting with the presumption that the market makes mistakes, so it can't be that. Is it because market values are easy to get? They are easy to get. But book values are just as easy, right? Shareholders' equity is right there on the balance sheet. Book value of debt is right there. So they're both easy to get, so that can't be the reason. Is it because book values of debt and equity are meaningless? It's kind of an easy shield to use. I don't trust accountants. Why would I use an accounting number? You might be able to get away with it, but that isn't it either. So what the hell is it? A little later when we do valuation, I'm going to come back to this issue. But let's say you use market value weights, and you say market value of equity is 800, market value of debt is 200. You come up with these weights, you come up with the cost of capital, and you value the company. You come up with a different value. Let's say your equity value is 600 million. That sounds contradictory, right? You started the process assuming 800, you're ending the process saying it's worth 600. Here's how I would justify it. When I think about cost of capital, it's a cost to me of acquiring this entire company in the market today. That's what a cost of capital is. So if I decide to buy Tesla, the whole company, you remember my intrinsic valuation of Tesla was what? 430 and looking increasingly desolate as it goes to 840, 900, 9,000, whatever it's going. Could I go to the market and say, look, guys, I value Tesla at 430. I can pay only 430. Sell your shares to me. Stock's trading at 840. There's no way I can buy the shares at 430. So what you and I think about intrinsic value doesn't matter if I'm going to go out and buy the equity in the market today, because guess what I have to pay? I have to pay market value. The reason we use market value weights is that's what it'll cost us to acquire the company today. It's not because the market is right or the market is wrong. It's just because that's what the transaction cost will be for me to acquire all the equity. We use market value weights to come up with cost of capital because every valuation is inherently a valuation of the entire company. That's what an intrinsic valuation is, and market value is what I have to pay to complete the acquisition. So here's what I'm ready to do, my cost of cap for Embraer. So let me go through the numbers, and it kind of brings together the last 40 pages because it's kind of in there. I first chose to do my valuation of Embraer in U.S. dollars. Why? Because in 2004, the Brazilian government did not have 10-year bonds denominated in reais. I could not even get a risk-free rate, so I decided to do the valuation in dollars. Where did that show up? My risk-free rate is a dollar risk-free rate. That's a 10-year bond rate, 4.29%, the USD bond. The beta that I used was the bottom-up beta for Embraer. If you remember, I got this by looking at global aerospace companies and adjusting for the tax rate and the debt ratio for Embraer. That's my 1.07. The 4% is my mature market premium for the U.S. based on the implied equity risk premium in 2004. So risk-free rate in dollars, beta for aerospace, my foot. The lambda that I used was actually the lambda that I got by regressing returns in Embraer against returns on the Brazilian dollar bond. It's a measure of how much risk does Embraer face. That's a 0.27. It's low because Embraer gets so much of its revenues outside Brazil. And the equity, the country risk premium for Brazil, the additional risk premium based on their default spread was an extra 7.89%. You bring those all together, my dollar cost of equity in 2004 for Embraer was 10.7%. So each of those ingredients is a story. The market value of equity was 11.04 billion reais, dollars. It doesn't matter. Weights are weights. Whether you do it in reais or dollars, you're going to get the same weights. Cost of debt, I started with the same risk-free rate, 4.29%. I added 1% based on the synthetic rating in the interest coverage ratio, and 4% because Brazil is a risky country, I get 9.29%. I multiplied by 1 minus the tax rate, which in 2004 for Brazil was 34%, the marginal tax rate. That's my after-tax cost of debt. My market value of debt was 2,083 million. And I got stuck on the market value of debt for a while for a simple reason. Much of Embraer's debt is not traded. Equity was easy, share price times number of shares. Debt was more difficult. That's why in investment banks, they do a little jig saying it's too difficult to get market value of debt. We'll just use book value of debt as market value. Most of the time, you can get away with it until you cannot. So I'll give you a very simple trick to convert book debt to market debt. You know how to compute the price of a bond? Somebody help me out here. How do you compute the price of a bond? Hate to put you on the spot. The coupons and the face value at the market interest rate today, right? So if I gave you a bond with a 5% coupon rate and a 10-year maturity, you take $50 every year for the next 10 years, $1,000 at the end of the 10th year, and you discount it back at what the market interest rate would be for that bond today. You ready? We're going to take all of the debt on a balance sheet and treat it like a bond. In the case of Embraer, their book debt was $1.95 billion. So think of that as a gigantic bond with a face value of $1.95 billion. The interest expenses were $222 million. Let's think of that as a coupon. And the average maturity of this debt was about 4 years. Right? So think of this as a four-year bond with $222 million in coupon for the next 4 years. That's the present value of an annuity, plus $1,953 million as the face value, and that's going to come in at the end of the fourth year, all discounted back at the 9.29%, which is what they should be paying for the debt today. What I get as a present value is $2.083 billion. That's my market value of debt. So if you want to take the book debt on your company's balance sheet, convert to market debt, I'm going to go through the things you need, and you tell me where in the balance sheet you'll find it. First, you need the book value of debt. That's going to be easy. Go to the balance sheet, look up total debt. That's the book value of debt. You need interest expenses, which is you're going to find in. Go to the income statement, look up the interest expenses. You need the average maturity for the debt. That's going to be in the footnotes. Keep looking. Because most companies will tell you when the debt comes to you. They actually won't tell you average maturity. So don't do a search average maturity. The PDF file won't find it. They'll give you a table. This much debt comes in year one, year two, year three, year four, and beyond year five. Put into a spreadsheet, compute an average maturity. In fact, if you have access to a Bloomberg terminal and you type in, you can actually get the average maturity for your debt. I'll send you the symbols you use. So basically, you can see the breakdown for the debt. You get those three numbers, and you have your pre-tax cost of debt. You can convert book debt to market debt. And that's something you need to come up with the cost of capital, because it's the market values that I use to get 84% equity and 16% debt at Embraer, and a cost of capital in U.S. dollar terms in 2004 of 9.97%. So there are lots of moving pieces here, and the key for you is to make sure you're working in the same currency when you do equity and debt. Make sure you're bringing in the market risk of equity when you do the betas and the cost of equity and the default spread into the cost of debt. Make sure you capture the tax difference in that 1 minus T. And make sure you're reflecting how much of each you want, each you use by using market values. And you should have a cost of capital for a company. Any questions on cost of capital? So let's say you do this for Embraer. You've done a dollar cost of capital, right? Let's say it's May 3rd. Remember, the project is due May 11th. You look at your dollar cost of capital. You haven't done the cash flows yet. And you say, you know what? I want to do everything in nominal reais. Part of you say, no way, I can't get started again. I'm going to give you a quick and dirty way in which you can convert your dollar cost of capital into a nominal reais cost of capital. And it draws from what we said about currencies. What is it that causes different risk-free rates in different currencies? Differences in inflation, right? So if I gave you a dollar cost of capital of 9.97%, and then I told you the inflation rate in reais is 8%, the inflation rate in U.S. dollars is 2%, you can convert your dollar cost of capital into a reais cost of capital by taking 1 plus the cost of capital in dollar terms. There's a compounding effect if you want to do it right. 8% is the inflation rate in Brazil, 2% is the inflation rate in the U.S., and my REI cost of capital will be about 16.44%. In fact, if you wanted to use the shortcut, you can just take the difference. 8 minus 2 is 6. Add that to the 9.97%. It'll be off because you're not capturing the compounding. But if you're in a hurry, you can convert a dollar cost of capital into any currency, which means you can reserve the right to switch to a different currency very late in the game without having to do everything from scratch. Your beta stays the same, risk premium stays the same. It allows you to compute a cost of capital in any currency. Final couple of pieces on cost of capital. So we've talked about debt and equity as the two ways you can raise capital, right? And that's technically the only two ways you can raise capital, debt and equity. But sometimes companies create what are called hybrid securities. What are hybrid securities? They're part debt, part equity. I'll give you a couple of examples. You know what a convertible bond is? Somebody describe it. What do you get with a convertible bond?
When it's originally a bond, and then when the market price
reaches a
level that you can execute
the option to buy the shares. Okay, so basically it looks like a conventional bond. It's got a coupon rate and a face value and a maturity. But during the life of the bond, you have the right to convert the bond into shares of stock of the underlying company. Whether you exercise the right or not will depend on what happens to the share price. Like a lot of Tesla's debt. That worried me when the stock price was 190. The problem disappeared. You know why? Because a lot of its debt is convertible debt with a $350 exercise price. So when the stock price hit 400 and kept going, it made it a much safer company almost magically because all that debt became equity. So you have with a convertible bond, straight debt, and you have a conversion option. That's one type of hybrid. It's the easiest hybrid to work with. There's another messier hybrid called preferred stock. What are you saying? What's preferred stock? Preferred stock comes with a fixed dividend in the U.S. So traditional common stock, I tell you I might pay a dividend, I might not, but there's no fixed dividend rate. So when you buy shares, in IBM equity, I don't say, look, you know, you get 3%. You might hope to get it given my history, but when you buy preferred shares, it comes like a bond with a preferred dividend rate. You don't get any voting rights. And in the U.S., at least, preferred stock is just terrible debt, terrible bonds. And here's why. You get all the disadvantages of debt because you promised a fixed dividend. But you know what you lose? One of the big advantages of debt? Or 1 minus T, the tax advantage. With preferred stock, you don't get that. In fact, one of the great mysteries, it's really not a mystery, one of the great stupidities in corporate finance is companies that keep issuing preferred stock when they can issue debt. Okay. And they do it for terrible reasons. You know the biggest issues of preferred stock in the U.S. are? One is very young growth companies who have convertible preferred, which you can understand. They have no tax advantage to begin with because they're losing money. They're convertible because everybody wants an equity. They don't care about the preferred. So VCs will often get convertible preferred because it gives them the right to the cash flows and negotiate for better things. But the biggest users of preferred stock in the U.S. are banks and financial service companies. You know why they issue preferred stock? Banks are governed by regulatory capital requirements, which means they need to have a certain amount of regulatory capital as a percentage of their loans to keep operating. And for whatever reason, regulatory capital authorities treat preferred stock as equity, not debt. They actually treat it as part of regulatory capital. So it's true, you're issuing very expensive debt, but in the process, it's getting counted as equity. You're looking safe. You're saying, this is good. It's not great for your stockholders because they now are getting this debt on which you don't get a tax advantage. But you can get preferred stock as a component of capital. So let me start with a convertible bond and see how I would deal with it in a cost of capital calculation. Then we'll talk about what to do about preferred stock. So let's assume you have a company. It has a $125 million convertible bond with a face value of $125 million and a stated interest rate of 4%. So let's stop right there. If this had been a straight bond, $125 million would have been the face value. And every year, 4% of $125 million is $10 million. Interest expense would have been $10 million every year for the next 10 years. This bond is trading at $140 million. Set that to the side. This bond also can be converted to equity. Now, there are two ways you can value convertible debt. One is to use an option pricing model to value the conversion option and valuing the straight debt and adding the two together. But I'm going to cheat. Which of those two should be easy to value, the option part or the straight bond part? The straight bond part. So here's what I did. I acted like it wasn't a convertible bond. It was just a regular bond. I said, if this bond had been just traditional debt, a straight bond, how much would I have paid for it? Remember, I have $10 million in interest expenses every year. The interest rate I should be paying on this bond, if it had been a straight bond, would have been 8%. If I take the value of this bond using that 8% interest rate, the value I'd have got would have been $91.45 million. So if this bond had just been a conventional bond, I'd have paid $91 million. What's the market value of the bond? $140 million. So why are people paying the extra $49 million? It must be for the conversion option. And what's a conversion option? It's equity. So when I do the cost of capital for the company, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the $140 million. I'm going to take $49 million and add it to equity, because it's really equity. Take the $91 million and treat it as debt. And there goes my hybrid. It's out of the picture. I have debt and equity. Because as much as I can, I want to go back to those two basic buckets. Because hybrids mess my life up in terms of calculations. And I want to avoid having them as much as I can. With preferred, you have no choice. You have to open up a third source of capital and deal with it. But with convertible debt, break the debt down into a debt and equity portions, get rid of it, and have only two items in your cost of capital. Your life will get a lot simpler. So let's see what the cost of capital looks like. Cost of capital, cost of equity comes from a bottom-up beta risk-free rate. We talked about that. The cost of debt should reflect the risk-free rate plus a default spread, either from an actual or a synthetic rating. The tax rate should be the marginal tax rate because you save taxes at the margin. The weight should be market value weights. You bring them all together. You got a cost of capital for your company in whatever currency you've chosen to do it in. And you can convert currencies using that inflation differential. Okay. Any questions on cost of equity or cost of capital? One of the reasons I keep nagging you to pick a company is until you actually do this for a company, it won't stick. You can work through as many practice problems as you want, but it's not going to stick. So you really need to get your hands dirty doing this for a real company in real time. because that's the only way, because there are a lot of moving pieces. Each piece is not complex, but if you don't bring them all together in the same calculation, you'll very quickly forget about all of the pieces. So try to do this on your company, preferably as soon as you can while it's still fresh. It'll be great preparation, because remember, you have a quiz coming in a couple of weeks, so this is actually one of the things that you can do to start getting ready for the quiz, is doing this on your company as part of the preparation. So now let's talk about cash flows. So when you think about cash flows, basically, here are the three steps. First, my base number is earnings. I need to start with earnings. Whether it's net income or after-tax operating income will depend on whether I'm doing equity or firm valuation. Second step in the process is I need to figure out how much of those earnings I'm putting back into the company as reinvestment. Defining reinvestment broadly to include any investment I'm making because I want to have future growth. So I start with earnings, I subtract out reinvestment. And if it's cash flows to equity, I've got to factor in payments to debt, interest and expenses, principal repayments. So it's a third layer. So I'm going to take each of these layers separately because I think each one requires some attention. Let's start with earnings. Okay? When you look at any measure of cash flow, every measure of cash flow starts with earnings. If it's free cash flow to the firm, you start with operating income. If it's free cash flow to equity, you start with net income. To get to cash flow, the reinvestment can take the form of either long-term investment, which is what capital expenditures minus depreciation captures, or investment in working capital, accounts receivable, inventory, and the change in working capital captures that. So those two items you see below the earnings are my reinvestment. If it's free cash flow to equity, I've got to bring in an additional item, which is how much debt am I repaying, how much new debt am I taking in. So if you break it down, I need earnings, I need this reinvestment number, whether it's that number, CapEx minus depreciation, is called net CapEx and working capital, and then I need debt payments. So let's start with the earnings number, because it's, after all, the number from which almost all valuation emanates. When you look at almost every one of these calculations, you'll see, as you go through the lecture notes, as you go through prompts, you'll see multiple ways in which I've computed the free cash flow of the firm. So I want to show you three different ways in which I can compute free cash flow of the firm. So when you see one, you don't say, oh my God, I've never seen that before. The long way is to start with after-tax operating income minus net capex and change in working capital gives me free cash flow of the firm. That's how in every valuation book you'd see it calculated. But I could do the same thing as if I took these two numbers, added them, I can call it reinvestment. So when you see that sales to invested capital for Tesla in my valuation, I compute reinvestment. I don't bother breaking it down into net capex and change in working capital because they both come out of my earnings anyway, so why does it matter? Or I can even state it as a ratio. The reinvestment rate is the percentage of my after-tax operating income that I put back in the business. Ultimately, though, every one of these numbers is going to be after taxes and after reinvestment. The question is how I frame that reinvestment. So we're going to spend some time on accounting earnings. And this is the part of the class I hate doing because I hate accounting earnings. But I have to do it anyway because that's where we all start. The raw data comes from accountants. So I'm going to start with a few things about earnings that I almost always have to do when I value a company. So you open up the last annual report or the last trailing 12-month numbers, and you're looking for earnings, right? First, make sure you track the right earnings. You can have net income, operating income. There are multiple measures of earnings. No. But there are three simple things that you have to do before you use those earnings as your base number. First, you want to make sure that that number is the most updated number you can get for this company. So if your annual report is from 2018, trust me, this is not the most updated number. Okay? Second, you might need to normalize that number. Why? Because if you have an oil company, earnings are going to go up and down. So you might have had a really good 2018, a really bad 2008. Is anybody valuing Boeing? Nobody wants to touch that monster. Yeah? But if you're valuing Boeing this year, and I want to value Boeing because now I think is a good time to value Boeing because everybody's kind of given up on the company. And I look at 2019 numbers, which should be coming out in a couple of weeks. You know what those numbers are going to look like? Terrible. They're going to have a $2 or $3 billion loss in 2019. Why? Because the 737 MAX caused the shutdown of operations. If I make that my steady state and say this is what Boeing is going to look like forever, the rest of the valuation becomes moot, right? The company is worth nothing. So when I value Boeing, I've got to say what would Boeing make in a normal year? That's going to take a little work because I've got to clean up. If I'm looking at an oil company, if last year was a year when oil prices were $120 a barrel, the numbers are going to be really high. If they were $30, much lower. But to value an oil company, I've got to normalize numbers. Now, normalization is part art, part science, so we're going to talk about how to do it, but that's the second thing to do. And third, you've got to clean up after the accountants. They've left quite a mess. I still remember my first accounting class, not fondly, but I do remember it. My accounting professor came in with three cardboard boxes. It's old, very old tech, no upscale, no, so three boxes, which he'd labeled. The first box he'd labeled operating expenses. The second box he'd labeled capital expenses. The third box he'd labeled financial expenses. And he made a statement that I know now is a lie, but I did not know then. He said, in accounting, we're religious about the way we classify expenses. If we have expenses that are designed to change revenue, affect revenues just this year, we put in the operating expense box, labor, materials. If we have expenses that create benefits over many years, we put it in the capital expense box. And if we have expenses associated with the use of debt, we put in the financial expense box. And each has its place, right? In an income statement, when you look at operating expenses, they show up in the income statement right below revenues to get to operating income. If you have capital expenses, what do you usually do? Because you get benefits over many years, you write them off for many years, and you call that write-off depreciation or amortization. And if you have financial expenses, you go back to the income statement, but you show it below the operating income line to get from operating to net income. And it sounded so logical and put together. Unfortunately, though, accountants are not that religious about putting items into the right boxes. I'm going to focus in on two of the most miscategorized items, one of which they finally got around to fixing this year, but it took them a long time. And the other is something I mentioned, R&D and the kinds of expenses that the companies of today face. Let's start with the first. So let's take each of these pieces and we'll work through. First, let's talk about updating numbers. As I said, your last annual report can be ancient. It can be from 2018. You can always get a more updated number for most companies by looking at the trailing 12 months. If your response is, how much can change in 9 months? Just check. For some of your companies, not much might change if it's a mature company. But if you take young, growing companies, an Uber or a Tesla, 9 months can make a huge difference in this company. So always look for more updated numbers. Now, if any of you are working in markets where companies don't update numbers every quarter, you might have to fill in the blanks. In fact, as a general rule, some of you are going to be working in markets where information you can get in the U.S. might not be available for your company. Don't change companies. Because everybody faces exactly the problem that you do, which is that it make your best estimates and move on. And your best estimate is not ignoring it. Remember, when you ignore something, you're making an estimate, right, which is zero. You can beat that usually by making your best judgment. So make your best judgment and fill in the gaps. But you want the most updated numbers you can when you value a company. It will mean that some of your inputs are more updated than others. That's part of life, right? Interest rates are always going to be more updated than accounting numbers. You are being internally consistent. You're getting the most updated values for every single input. So if you're sitting there with my spreadsheet and I ask you, what are your revenues in the last 12 months? Try to get the most recent numbers you can. Second, let's talk about correcting for accounting mistakes. There are two items I'm going to focus on. The first is leases, a historically miscategorized item. And I'll take you through the process of converting leases to what they should really be, which is debt, and how it plays out in income statements. The second is I want to talk generically about reinvestment and long-term investment and talk about things like R&D, which historically accountants have screwed up and treated as operating expenses, which really should be capital expense. I'll take you through the process of converting R&D to a capital expense and why it matters. So let's start with the lease issue. I don't know how many of you are doing restaurant companies, retailers, airlines. These are businesses where leases are a big expense. How big? A typical apparel store, 42% of its operating expenses are lease expenses. They show up as an operating expense. At least until last year, they showed up almost entirely as an operating expense. Furniture stores, almost 50%. Restaurants, almost 30%. The biggest single operating expense is a lease expense. But if any of you have signed a lease, what does it usually look like? It's usually there's a term, right? 5, 10 years. Let's say it specifies a fixed payment you got to make every year for those 5 or 10 years. Is that a contractual requirement when you sign this? I think so. So you can't sign a car lease and say, I didn't know you had to pay this amount. Do I really have to? No, you have to. It's a contract. So you basically are contracted to make those lease payments in good times and bad times. How can that not be debt? The essence of debt is you've entered into a contractual commitment to make payments. I have never understood why accountants have done what they have, which is to treat these lease expenses or operating expenses using some stupid ownership or no one. I really don't care whether you own the asset or not. It is a contractual commitment. It should be debt. And accountants have known for a long time this was a problem. How long? I actually found a panel discussion that happened at NYU in 1949. When accountants talked about how leases should be treated as debt, 1949. You know when they finally got around to doing it? 2019. There's a 70-year lag in accounting between recognizing there's a problem and actually doing something about it. So you know what this tells you, right? Don't wait for accountants to do the right thing. You might have to do it for them. So leases are definitely debt. And so if you give me a company with a lot of lease commitments, I'll take you through the process of converting leases to debt. And this is what accounting is starting to do this year. So you're going to see this play out in balance sheets starting this year. Until last year, here's what would happen. If you had a lease expense, you'd show me the lease expense as an operating expense. You'd show nothing in debt. So if you're a retailer and you had a 15-year lease, you showed nothing in debt. But in the footnotes, you would show what your lease commitments were for the next 5 years and beyond. So even though you didn't show it as debt, in the footnotes at least, you revealed how much your contractual commitments look like. So I'll take an example, because in the abstract, you're saying, what do I do with this? This is from the Gap in 2003. Gap, of course, is a retailer, lots of stores around the country. It doesn't own a single one of its stores. It leases every one of them. So it has these huge lease commitments. So if you look at the footnotes, so basically they said they had $978 million in lease expenses just in 2003. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. These are the contractual commitments they have to make lease payments in next year, 2 years out, 3 years out, 4 years out, 5 years out, and beyond. So if I look to the footnotes, that's what they told me the commitments were. So what am I saying? This is really debt, right? If I want to show it as debt, what do I need to do? I need to take these contractual commitments, discount them back to today using my pre-tax cost of debt as my discount rate. Why? Because these are pre-tax commitments. And what I get as a present value will be the debt value of leases. So if I do that, if I take the present value of those lease commitments, I come up with $4.4 billion. Let me pause right there. If you look at the Gap's balance sheet, you'll see $1.97 billion debt. So that's not too bad. They don't have much debt. I say, wait a moment. They have $4.4 billion in lease debt. The total debt at the Gap is not $1.97 billion. It's more than $6 billion because they have a substantial amount of lease debt. So when you take companies like Walmart and any restaurant, Applebee's, what you see on the balance sheet is just the tip of the debt iceberg. When you bring in lease commitments as debt, you're going to see a much larger number, but that's a much truer manifestation of what these companies owe in the future. So when I do cost of capital, that's basically what's going to play out is this $6.1 billion. So I actually did this at the Gap in 2004 because they even then accountants were talking about doing the right thing. So Gap said, you know, I knew one of my students actually is pretty high up in the finance group. He said, can you come in and talk to us about what the effects will be of converting leases to debt? So I took them through the process, and they went through various stages of delirium while I was doing it because there were highs and lows, and you're going to see what the highs were and what the lows were very quickly. I said, I'm going to show you what the numbers will look like, the way accountants are doing it now, and what they will look like if leases are treated as debt. Let me start with the good news. I said, right now, when I look at your income statement, I see operating income of $1.012 billion with leases treated as operating expenses. If leases were treated as debt, your income would be much higher. They said, this is good. My income will be much higher. Let's keep going, keep going. I said, okay, I'll keep going. Because now I'm taking the lease expense out, so operating income will be higher. Then I said, you know what, right now, when I look at your balance sheet, you have only $1.97 billion in debt, but when I count leases as debt, you're going to look like you have more debt. And they were a little down on this. He said, that's not good, is it? I said, well, no, there's a good side to having more debt. Because when I compute cost of capital and I compute it based on debt, with the old debt, the cost of capital I had was 7.31% because I wasn't counting. But if I count leases as debt, your cost of capital actually, now you're at peak delirium. My earnings are higher, my cost of capital is lower, everything's well with the world, this is good, come on in. And I said there's one final catch to this entire process, which is when you grow, one of the things I look at is what kind of returns you make on your invested capital, because that drives value. I said, right now, when I compute that return on invested capital and I use the conventional definition of debt, it looks like your return on capital is about 12.9%. It looks like you're earning a high return. But if I bring leases into the debt and I can compute your return on capital, your return on capital is only 9.3%. Now they're completely confused. They said, okay, so our cost of capital is lower, our earnings are higher, our returns on capital are going to be lower. What does this all mean for our value? I said I would have to do a full valuation, but I can give you a snapshot of what's going to happen. One measure of how good a company is the spread the company earns between the return on capital and its cost of capital. So that's what you're earning. So right now, before my adjustment, the spread is about 5.5%, 12.9 minus 7.31%. After I make the conversion, both numbers change, right? The cost of capital goes up, the return on capital comes down. Both go down. The difference goes to 3%. In the case of the gap at least, converting leases to debt actually reduced their value by about 5%. It depends on the company. Some companies, converting leases to debt will increase value. Some of them, it will not leave value unchanged, because if that were the case, we would not bother. But what this gives you is a much cleaner measure of what the actual debt of this company is. So I'm going to kind of close this part of the process. It's not just leases that should worry you, because that problem is pretty much behind us now, right? The economy will come to their senses. Anybody here valuing Netflix? Okay, you're valuing Netflix. I'll come back to you. Anybody here have Netflix? What is so great about Netflix? You turn it on, and every day they have like 15 new shows that show up out of nowhere, 3 new seasons every season. And until 2013, they had content from all over. The most watched show last year on Netflix was? Come on, it wasn't Strange. It wasn't any of their original content. It was Friends. It's a scary thing. You know, we get to Netflix, and what do? Watch Friends over and over again for the rest of eternity. Okay. But how does Netflix get the... In fact, they now have the rights to Seinfeld for the next 4 years. Another oldie plus goodie show. I have like DVDs and I might even have videotapes. So how does Netflix get the right to these shows? It goes to a studio and signs a contract. In the case of, I think, Seinfeld, it was $600 million for the next 4 years. Contractual commitment? Absolutely. Whether one person watches Seinfeld or $50 million, they've got to pay that. If you go to the Netflix balance sheet and go to the footnotes, when they have the footnotes for lease commitments, they also have a column for content commitments. You know what that's for? That's for all the shows they've acquired from other producers. They now are contracted to pay for the next 3, 4, 5 years. I think they have the rights to the Avengers, at least one of the movies, for the next 3 years. They have to pay Disney $100 million a year. That's what the contract... So when I compute the debt ratio for Netflix, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to treat the contractual commitments as debt. One final example, and I'll let you go. Any Yankee fans here? No Yankee fans? What the hell is wrong with you guys? No. I'm going to put up my hand. At least one person. So you're Mets fans? That's pathetic. How about Red Sox fans? Hey, more Red Sox. What is this? We're at NYU. We have two more Red Sox fans. But forget about it. No. But in 2009, the Yankees built a new stadium. And I offered my kids a deal. I said, there's a new stadium. Don't you want to be able to tell your children and grandchildren that you went to opening day in the new stadium? So I offered this to all four of my kids and ended up taking only my 3 sons to the game. There's nothing sexist about this. But the question my daughter asked is, will there be, you know, there's ice cream that comes in drops. What's that called? The little droplets. You know the one I'm talking about? Will there be Dippin' Dots there? I said, what? I'm offering you, offering to take you to Yankee Stadium, and you say, will there be, I'm not walking around the stadium looking for Dippin' Dots for you in the middle of a game, so you can stay home. So I took my three sons. We sat in the bleachers, and I paid bleacher price. I bought it on StubHub or some, sitting up, opening day. The Yankees run onto the field. The home team gets run. And as they run on, all I can think of is debt and equity. You're saying, this is so sick. Because here's what I saw running on. I saw a guy called Mark Teixeira run out to first base, and all I could think of was 7 years of $20 million a year contractually committed. And then I saw Robinson Cano, at that time my cheap infielder. I said, that's good, only $12 million for the next 3 years. And I said, Derek Jeter, $20 million for the next 5 years. There was an imposter on third base that day.